I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Daniel Tordei, winner of the National Jewish Book Award for his first novel, The Last Flight of Poxel West. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mavina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinchinim, Bar El Kachar, and Leah Avuno, and our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. A not-so-cheerful subject has emerged as an important theme in American Jewish life yet again, anti-Semitism. The thing about anti-Semitism is that just when you think it's receded from view and is no longer a serious problem in one sector of society or one nation in the world, it comes creeping back. And there is now increasing concern that anti-Semitism is making inroads here in the United States. The new American Jewish concern about heightened degrees of this evil comes as a result of some of the very ugly themes of the recent presidential election campaign, particularly the focus it brought to what is called the alt-right movement and the alternative, that is, fake news, that some of its elements have spawned. There were a number of instances during the presidential campaign and in its immediate aftermath of anti-Semitic chants, of reporters blasted with anti-Semitic and neo-Nazi harangues, of commercials hinting at Nazi-era slurs about Jewish control of world finance or the media, and other disturbing incidents. We haven't seen anything quite like this in America in many years. After the election, the appointment of Steve Bannon as senior advisor and chief strategist to Donald Trump with a White House office was met with Jewish concern, fear, and anger. Bannon heads the Breitbart fake news website with its preference for conspiracy theories and its many anti-Semitic followers and bloggers. And on college campuses, the left-wing anti-Israel anti-Semitism has now been joined by alt-right anti-Jewish propaganda on many campuses. Mark Potok, a senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center, which carefully monitors anti-Semitic activity, notes that there was a rash of post-election hate crimes in the 10 days after the election, including 80 incidents of swastika graffiti in America. As Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, said recently, "In short, the American Jewish community has not seen this level of anti-Semitism in mainstream political and public discourse since the 1930s, you know, the bad old days of Father Coughlin." It should be noted that many of these anti-Semitic individuals and electronic media types and websites are usually, at the same time, very pro-Israel, in part because they are also usually highly nationalist in nature, and they see Israel as a nationalist bulwark against Islam. This seemingly strange combination of people who express dislike of Jews, as Steve Bannon has reportedly done, while also lauding Israel, has muted some Jewish criticism, but it has not allayed the deep concern expressed by most Jewish leaders. While America has a significant and bad history of anti-Semitism, over the past 50 years, the definite trend has been away from acceptance of anti-Semitic attitudes and restrictions in both public and private life. According to any measure you wish to use, Jews in 2016 America experience a level of acceptance in society that is nearly unprecedented in all of Jewish history. It would be very premature to announce that the recent rise of online and in-person anti-Semitic rhetoric and imagery is some sort of foundational change in this trend. But it's disturbing. And as always, we Jews need to be highly aware of the possibility of rising anti-Semitism, even here in the golden age of American Judaism, in the country that has given us such incredible freedom to be both fully Jewish and fully American and successful. Because religious freedom, like all freedom, must be guarded and protected for all religions in our American society. On that subject, the great Jewish holiday of religious freedom, Hanukkah, begins December 24th. At Temple Emmanuel, we'll celebrate our greatest Hanukkah on Earth 18 celebration this very afternoon, Sunday, December 11th, 4:30 p.m., a pre-Hanukkah festival that's free and open to all. Come join us as we celebrate the victory of the Hasmonean-led Jewish rebels against the mighty Syrian Greek tyrant and his armies in song, story, theater, dance, lights, everything. It's a great show, subtitled Shine All Night, and it's this afternoon, 4:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel. Don't miss it. To play us in this morning, we continue our pre-Hanukkah musical preview with Peter Yarrow's modern semi-classic Hanukkah song, Light One Candle.
Light one candle for the Maccabee children, with thanks to their light it didn't die. Light one candle for the pain they endured when their right to exist was denied. Light one candle for the terrible sacrifice justice and freedom demand. Light one candle for the wisdom to know when the peacemaker's time is at hand. Don't let the light go out, it's lasted for so many years. Don't let the light go out, let it shine through our love and our tears. As it is so many years. Don't let the light go out, let it shine through our love and our tears.
Light one candle for the strength that we need to never become our own foe.
And light one candle for those who are suffering pain we learned so long ago. Light one candle for all we believe in. Let anger not tear us apart. Light one candle to bind us together with peace as the song in our heart. Don't let the light go out, it's lasted for so many years. Don't let the light go out, let it shine through our love and our tears.
That was Light One Candle, sung by Peter, Paul, and Mary for the coming holiday of Hanukkah, 2 weeks away. But don't miss the greatest Hanukkah honor celebration at Temple Emmanuel this very afternoon, Sunday, December 11th, 4:30 p.m., 225 North Country Club Road. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, author Daniel Torday, has written a terrific novel, The Last Flight of Poxel West, which won the National Jewish Book Award. Hear about it when we return in just a moment on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Hi, my name is Lauriella, and I'd like to tell you how you can help send children like me to a Jewish day school at no cost to you. Arizona allows its taxpayers to receive a tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations such as JETCO. JETCO is the only tuition organization solely dedicated to Jewish education in Tucson. JETCO provides scholarships to children who attend qualified private schools like Congregation Anshai Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, which educates students from grades K through 8th. You may give up to $1,087 for single tax filers and $2,173 for married couples who file jointly. Jewish education nurtures Jewish identity for generations of students like me, so please go online and visit our website at www.jetco.org or give JETCO a call at 647-8442. Again, that's 647-8442. And tell them Lauriella sent you.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Daniel Tordei is the Director of Creative Writing at Bryn Mawr College. He's the author of The Last Flight of Poxel West, a new and really terrific novel. His collections of short stories and his short stories have appeared in a wide variety of magazines, and he won the 2012 National Jewish Book Award for debut fiction with his novella, The Centralist. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I really liked your book. I might sound like a bad fan, but...
I'll accept any kind of fan.
What made you decide to write about, first of all, World War II / more contemporary, you know, it cuts back and forth between different times. What led you to this novel in the first place?
Yeah, so I actually am not like a huge World War II buff, but I have the sort of family history of having grandparents who came over from Hungary right after World War II and who were forced essentially to leave Hungary after the Holocaust. After surviving there, they had a very big extended Eastern European family, and the model for Poxel, the main character in the book, was my grandmother's first cousin, this guy named Hansa North, who died about 3 years ago, and who I spent a lot of time both with as a family member, but also in doing some research for the novel. So it's always hard to say how some decisions get made while writing, but there was sort of a combination between having gotten this single voice down and Poxel's voice in a memoir that he wrote, and then always knowing that I kind of wanted to be able to update it in some way with a second voice. It kind of came along mysteriously, but it's not quite contemporary. It takes place in 1986, and I think goes up to probably about 1990. So it's more contemporary. But.
Right. I'm just showing how old I am, actually. When you're talking about, you know, Boston sports in the 1980s, you're right. It's now 25, 30 years ago. But
kind of hard to believe, right?
Yeah, shocking. There's a very interesting and a very important Holocaust element. In many ways, it's a very Jewish book. And his Jewish identity is very important, and yet not in a religious sense. Talk about that a little bit, if you would.
Yeah, you know, you've kind of hit on what, for me, I think in most of my work has always been a kind of, I don't know if I want to say conflict or problem, but definitely a thing that I think about a lot, which is that there's this kind of cultural Judaism that the characters kind of take on because that's just the air that I breathe. And then a hope to be able to do something that's a little bit more religious and more sort of immediately taking on Judaism as a religion that, you know, I think I always find mysterious. There's a through line in Poxel where the contemporary-ish narrator has kind of taken an interest in Kabbalah.
Right.
Some of that came from just like being back at my parents' house in Los Angeles one day while writing and pulling these books down from off the shelf that Daniel C. Matt and Gershom Scholem that I had gotten really into when I was like 15 or 16 years old and updating it. So I think there's always sort of a balance between just the material that's close to hand and then wanting to find some ways to ask some of the bigger questions.
There are no accidents, by the way. I happen to bring this book in. We have a Zohar study group. We use Danny Matt's translation. So
you're kidding.
No, I am not. Some things are meant to be. We will talk much more with Daniel Tordei about his terrific novel, The Last Flight of Poxel West, and writing and Judaism. We come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. We welcome our friends David and Pamela from Freedom Smoke. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So your product is kosher?
Yes. The base ingredients, the propylene glycol vegetable glycerin, are both certified kosher USP grade. It's basically the same product that's put in asthma inhalers.
Where do you get your flavorings from?
Our flavorings come from Flavor Art in Italy. It is definitely the finest flavorings in the world.
And people have a variety of choices.
Yes, they do. We've got over 500 flavors.
Now, the quality of what you provide is very important.
Yes, it is. When people come in, we first find out what kind of cigarettes they've been using, so we know the approximate level of nicotine they'll need. Then we fit them with a flavor that would be perfect for them.
How can people find out more? Where can they go?
They can do one of a couple of things. They can visit us on our website at freedomsmokeusa.com. That's all one word. Or call us on our 800 number, 800-705-7013.
Thanks so much.
A pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Ekfell, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com, TOOJewishRadio18@gmail, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, twojewishradio.com, by streaming us or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, there's been concerns about a recurrence of anti-Semitism. It never seems to go away in Europe, and now people are concerned in America, but not all the signs are pointing towards that. There was an election in Austria recently. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Right. Well, it was basically a sort of centrist candidate mainstream against a far-right candidate who some characterized rightly or wrongly as neo-Nazi. And the far-right candidate was trounced and handed a stunning defeat in what many Europeans hope is a sign that the wave of victories for the far-right, which they've seen in France. Some people, I think especially here, wrongly interpret the Brexit vote to be a victory for the far right. These are victories for like nationalism, xenophobia, extremism, anti-Semitism, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, didn't happen in Austria. And I don't think there's a huge wave of extremism, neo-Nazism, anti-Semitism washing over Europe. I think there is concern, as we've talked about on this show, with immigrants, particularly from the Syrian civil war, and a kind of flood of alien-looking people, women who wear veils or cover their heads, and men with big beards and mullahs. And most European countries are actually uncomfortable with extremism in any form, whether it's Christian extremism, Muslim extremism, Jewish extremism, whatever. So, you know, Austria is a special case because many American Jews consider it to be a haven for anti-Semites. And even during the war, families were divided the same way they were in Berlin. Families were divided over how to treat Jews, their Jewish neighbors, their Jewish friends, in many cases, Jewish relatives. There were families where one branch of the family was Christian, one branch was Jewish. How to deal with Nazis, whether to welcome them or try to repel them. Lots of people welcomed them, but lots of people didn't. And I think the same would be true today. There are probably, you know, a significant number of people who would vote in favor of a neo-Nazi party. But as we just saw, lots of people who voted against what isn't ultimately a neo-Nazi party anyway. The Austrians and the international press in general have a tendency to characterize whoever is the candidate of the far right as the new Hitler or as a neo-Nazi. Not always the case. It's especially tempting to do that in Austria and Germany, probably no more justified than it is anywhere else in Europe.
Yeah, it's a good lesson. You know, there's an assumption. Hitler, of course, was Austrian, and there's strong people with long memories remember Kurt Waldheim and many other sort of elements that show that Austrians hadn't totally come to terms with the history of the Nazi era. But that's probably not complete or fair.
Well, there are lots of Austrians just like there are lots of Americans. And a range of opinions and tastes just like there are here.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We started talking about the Israeli electoral process, which is quite complicated, last week, since we're, you know, kind of following the American electoral season. How does the prime minister get chosen in Israel? Because prime minister is the equivalent of the president of the United States, but it's not a direct election.
Yeah, it's not a direct election. It's actually, so after every list or every party get number of, you know, mandates.
Yeah, so a number of seats in the Knesset.
Out of 120.
So they might propose a list, like say you're Likud, and you propose a list of 35 candidates and you win 22 seats. So the top 22 people, you have enough votes that up those 22 people are in the Knesset. They're part
yes.
of the Knesset.
But in order to form a government, you need to have at least 61.
Because it's 120 seats in the Knesset.
Yeah, so you have the majority. Usually they will have this conversation prior to the election, of course.
Of course.
And then the president will call in, you know, the one who, the party, the head of the party who had the majority of...
it's almost never a majority now. Usually,
the most
the
votes.
Plurality, the
yeah,
largest number
exactly.
of seats in the Knesset.
And then he will ask him if he has, if he can... put together a government, and we give him some time to put together, you know, a
the
government.
The 61 votes that he needs to
yes,
be approved
at least.
As prime minister. Yeah. At least 61. Right?
This government is actually 61.
Right.
It's
just
a very narrow.
You know,
yeah.
Narrow.
Yeah, very narrow.
Narrow,
and it's very hard to work with a very narrow government, but it's possible. And then he has some time to put together a government. And if he's not able to put, like Tzipi Livni, you know, if you remember.
Yeah, so I remember when Tzipi Livni had the largest party, and I think Perez might have been president then, asked her,
no,
it was Katsav,
yes.
but they asked her to form the government, and
she
couldn't,
wasn't, yeah.
she couldn't find enough other people
no,
who
she
would
didn't
play in the sandbox.
Yeah. Believe me, there was parties that wanted to join, but she had her own agenda and she didn't want to...
Yeah, she didn't want to give them what they wanted,
yes,
the right
exactly.
ministries or the right
yeah.
patronage, mm-hmm. right.
So she wasn't able to put together the government. And we know who
managed it after her.
Yes.
Right.
And still.
So Bibi Netanyahu also, there was a brief time when the Israeli law changed and they elected the prime minister directly.
Directly. It was only once. Yeah.
That happened once, and it was Netanyahu that
mm-hmm.
won that
it was
election
once.
Too.
Mm-hmm.
And then they changed back. Why
mm-hmm.
did they change back?
It's the same problem that you can have if you have a president here that don't have majority. You know,
in
if
Congress.
He's Republican and he doesn't have Republican in the House or the Senate, then, you know, he can't
accomplish
really
anything.
Accomplish.
It creates paralysis.
So that was the problem, and that's why it was
and
changed.
So they decided that
I
wasn't
do remember.
A functional. So there you go. They decided it wasn't a functional way to run the country, which
uh-huh.
you can make that case based on the United
yes.
States at times, too. And so now the prime minister is chosen from the majority party. As soon as he forms a coalition, they propose the government with all the ministers, and
mm-hmm.
that's usually from the other parties that he's worked with plus
mm-hmm.
his own party.
Yes.
And usually not the parties that don't go into the government. And then that's given to the president, but there's really no formal approval. It's done, right, at that
but
point?
As soon as he come, you know, he will come twice to the president. Once he will get... you know, the president will nominate him to do it, and
minister,
then he
right.
will approve it. Yeah, definitely.
Right. So that's when they take the oath of office, and it formally
yes.
acknowledges the government.
Mm-hmm.
And then the government lasts until the people disagree too much, and it breaks apart. Lasts all 4 years. It always breaks up sometime along the way, and they have to
yeah.
have more elections, and you go through the same process.
Even after 2 years, I remember once
after two years,
which is awful.
It almost makes the American system seem civilized, almost. Thanks, Ashrat. We'll talk next week.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Jarrow Psych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Tov. Good morning.
Good morning. We started talking about tzedakah and how we teach the value of generosity, of giving, of caring, empathy to kids.
Yes.
Sometimes our kids teach us.
Right, absolutely. You know, it's astonishing how much we can learn from children. Last weekend, we talked a little bit about growing empathy and understanding and that kind of leading into compassion and caring. And we see examples of that all the time when we watch child behavior. You know, there's an inclination to care for animals and then worry about the world. So when we pay attention to those cues, we can really help kids to grow and to learn how important it is to take those thoughts and really apply them to the world and work on tikkun olam and being charitable out there. An amazing example of this when kids are getting older is where we see the bar and bar mitzvah projects that our synagogues so beautifully champion and advocate through that process.
Yeah, we call it a mitzvah project at my congregation. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got a slightly different name, but the idea is you have to do something for somebody else while you're in the process of focusing on becoming an adult.
It isn't just about you and, you know, the individual's moment or, you know, how big of a party and kind of presence. And I see a lot of kids really focusing on the valuable things that come along with all the great stuff. But kids really get it. And it's exciting to see the variety of mitzvah projects that they develop.
When we do those mitzvah projects, after all, the children are 12. It's not usually the case that they can figure this out by themselves. Occasionally, you get some incredibly entrepreneurial 12-year-old, but usually the parents, the grandparents, somebody has to be deeply involved
sure,
in that.
Sure, the family's got to play a critical role, and without that support, it's difficult for kids to be doing these things on their own. And that kind of comes back also to the job we have as adults, as educators, as role models, to be demonstrating tzedakah, to be a resource so that they see that, you know, tzedakah is no a once-in-a-year event. It's not a once-in-a-lifetime event. It's something that you do all the time.
You have to create a culture in which giving becomes central. Maybe next week we'll talk about some aspects of that as part of the way that not only do we integrate it in kids' education, but in adult experience, so central to Judaism.
Absolutely, and it's that giving time of year.
Absolutely. Thanks, John. We'll talk next week. When we return on To Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One day Rivka goes to the dentist and asks him how much it'll cost to extract a wisdom tooth. That's $600, the dentist says. What a ridiculous amount, Rivka says. Isn't there a cheaper way? Well, the dentist says, if I don't use anesthetic, I can knock it down to $400. Still too expensive, Rivka says. Okay, says the dentist. If I save on anesthesia and just rip the tooth out with a pair of pliers, I could get away with charging you just $100. No, moans Rivka, still too much. Says the dentist, scratching his head. If I let one of my students do it without anesthetic and he uses a pair of old rusty pliers, you know, just for the experience, you understand, I suppose I could charge you just $25. Marvelous, says Rivka. Book my husband Moishe for next Tuesday. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And maybe don't go to the dentist if your wife makes the appointment. And now a word of Torah. We are currently in the midst of a sequence of splendid Torah portions, rich in complexity, action, and misdeed, all blended together with some serious family dysfunction. This week's Sedra Vayishlach in Genesis continues the tale of Jacob, most intriguing of our patriarchs, a man who rises above his own duplicitous nature to become the father of almost all the tribes of Israel. As our story begins, Jacob is returning home to Canaan, having made good in the old country of Sumeria in Haran, today's Turkey near Syria. He has 4 wives, 12 children, including 11 sons, entire football team, flocks of sheep, herds of cattle, great wealth. As he's about to cross into Canaan, he learns that his brother Esau, whom he wronged so seriously just before leaving home in a rush 20 years earlier, is coming to meet him with an army of 400 men. Jacob panics at the news, deducing that Esau is not headed his way with 400 guys with spears just to welcome him home. To try to preserve at least half his household, Jacob divides his family and possessions into two camps, carefully arranges a large gift for Esau, and that night goes onto a small island in the midst of a tributary of the Jordan River to contemplate his options. While he's there, a stranger appears to him. The Torah is unclear as to whether this nocturnal visitor is a man, an angel, a representative of God in some other way, or even a character in his dream. Jacob wrestles with the visitor the rest of the night, and finally, as dawn is breaking, he prevails. The stranger cannot break away, and before he can escape, Jacob insists the stranger give him a blessing. It is at this moment that Jacob is blessed with a new name, Yisrael, Israel, the first time that famous name is used in all history. It means either a prince of God, or more likely, one who wrestles with God, and we children of Israel, in other words, Jacob, have been wrestling with God in one way or another ever since. As the angel tells Jacob, "Your name shall be called Israel, for you have contended with gods and men and have prevailed." Jacob survives, and the reunion with Esau proves to be anticlimactic. Esau comes up to Jacob with all those armed men, but instead of attacking him, he gives his brother a big hug and a kiss. And if all is not forgiven, at least no blood is shed. The dramatic narrative of Jacob's struggle and triumph have become a metaphor for our own struggles with belief and with family baggage. We are all descendants of Yisrael, the one who wrestled with God, and if we engage in that process for the sake of sacredness and belief, we too may triumph and reach our own promised land. Even during a season of merciless commercialism, holiness can be created and found. It is that very search and struggle that make us the people of Israel, seeking holiness, and ultimately give us a land engaged in that same pursuit. When we truly are children of the one who wrestled with God, when we choose to wrestle with God, we elevate our lives and our experience. May we remember to do so in this crazy holiday season and in every season. When we return here on Too Jewish, our guest, Daniel Torday, author of The Last Flight of Poxel West, winner of the National Jewish Book Award, will explore flight and Judaism and historical fiction and lots more when we return on Too Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In an about-face that I'm sure had nothing whatsoever to do with the election of Donald Trump as President of the United States, Israel's chief rabbinate committed to creating standards for recognizing which diaspora rabbis it trusts to handle Jewish conversions. Last week, both the Ashkenazi and Sephardi chief rabbis of Israel announced, separately of course, that they would convene a meeting of the Chief Rabbinate Council and the Supreme Rabbinical Court next week to determine the standards. The conversion of Ivanka Trump, daughter of U.S. President-elect Donald Trump, will be recognized under the new standards, Chief Rabbi Yitzhak Yosef promised. It was in question just a couple weeks ago. This reform is expected to stop the suffering of many converts who have been through a conversion abroad when they come to register for marriage and divorce in Israel. In contrast to the situation in the past, in which some officials of the chief rabbinate assumed the authority to check every case individually, every conversion that will be approved by a rabbi who is on the list of approved rabbis will not be subject to further checking, but will be approved automatically. For example, What reached the headlines recently was the issue of the recognition of the conversion of Ivanka Trump, daughter of the president-elect of the United States. According to the new proposed outline, in which you check the converting rabbi only, that conversion would be legitimized without the need for further checking up, Yosef said. The chief rabbinate is Israel's highest Jewish authority with control over personal status, like conversion, marriage, and divorce. The chief rabbinate council is the advisory body, and the supreme rabbinical court, Beit Din, is the highest rabbinical court, which resolves disputes regarding personal status. The rabbinate released a list back in April of about 100 rabbis from the U.S. and 19 other countries whose authority over Jewish conversion it accepts. But the rabbinate attached a letter to that list saying it was not exhaustive and simply included rabbis whose authority had been accepted in the past. That's 100 rabbis out of the whole world, not very many. The letter also said there was no guarantee these rabbis would be trusted in the future. Oy. Controversially, the rabbinate's April list did not include many prominent modern Orthodox rabbis, like New York Rabbi Avi Weiss, who founded the progressive Open Orthodoxy movement. The ultra-Orthodox Haredi-dominated rabbinate has never recognized non-Orthodox rabbis or conversions, and in the past few years, it has questioned the credentials of a number of leading liberal Orthodox rabbis, or moderate ones anyway. In September, it was revealed the rabbinate rejected conversions by Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, head of the Rabbinical Council of America's Rabbinical Court. In July, the rabbinate rejected a conversion by Rabbi Haskell Lookstein, former leader of Kehilat Yeshurun in Manhattan's Upper East Side, who converted Ivanka Trump before her marriage to Jared Kushner. E-Team, an organization that helps Israelis navigate the state's ridiculous religious bureaucracy, petitioned a Jerusalem court in 2015 to pressure the rabbinate to be more transparent about how it determines what Jewish conversions are legitimate. That petition led to the release of the rabbinate's first list of rabbis this year, and it drew the attention of Itamar Tubul, a mid-level bureaucrat who sits in some small office in the rabbinate building, maybe in the dark, and apparently evaluates requests from Israeli immigrants seeking a marriage license and ensures that they are optimally Jewish. Rabbi Seth Farber, the director of E-Team, responded to the announcement with some optimism. "We are incredibly gratified the rabbinate has recognized its lack of policies regarding converts from overseas is harmful to Judaism in Israel and all around the world. I hope that the outcome of this assembly will remove the insane bureaucracy converts are forced to undergo to certify their Jewishness," he said. "We will need to see the results of these meetings and ensure the criteria do not exclude wide swaths of the Jewish people." But Rabbi Uri Regev, the head of Chidush, a past guest of Too Jewish. Chidush is an organization that promotes religious pluralism in Israel. Uri Regev was skeptical that the rabbinate was capable of liberalizing. "With the makeup of the group that is convening next week, in my view, it is very unlikely they will come up with an agreed-upon set of criteria that will be inclusive of the mainstream modern Orthodox rabbinate of North America today," he said. "They may approve of Rabbi Lookstein, but not because of Rabbi Lookstein, but because of Donald Trump. But there's no way in the world they will accept and legitimize the rank and file without further inquiry into every individual convert." And the beat goes on. In other news, in Germany, the firing of the director of the Polish Cultural Institute of Berlin has led to a diplomatic brouhaha in the German capital. It was alleged that she focused too much on Jewish topics and was, I am not making this up, too Jewish. The Jewish Museum is involved in defending Katarzyna Wielga-Skolimowska, who was let go last week by the Polish Foreign Ministry, ostensibly because she focused too much on Jewish topics, a charge the Polish embassy is vigorously denying. The Polish ambassador to Germany, Andrzej Przylebski, recently criticized the Polish Cultural Institute in a private memo for, among other things, spending more time on Jewish-Polish themes than on Polish-Ukrainian or Polish-Lithuanian dialogue. The Polish embassy has now written to two German newspapers demanding a public correction. "To link the decision to recall our colleague Katarzyna Wielga with the assertion that it was due to closeness to Jewish themes is misleading and wrong, and particularly irritating," read the letter from embassy press attaché Jacek Bigala. Katarzyna Wielga-Skolimowska has headed the Polish Cultural Institute in Berlin since 2013. She was fired by the right-wing foreign minister of Poland. Wielga Skolimowska is barred from speaking to the press while she's still employed by the foreign ministry, but others have come out in her defense. Notably, the Jewish Museum has asked Ambassador Przylebski to rescind the decision to fire her. She was called an excellent representative of Poland by the museum director. At the bottom of the issue is an ideological split in Poland between the nationalist conservatives who are now in power and those who take a more self-critical view of modern Polish history. Reportedly, Wielga Skolimowska was of the latter persuasion, and the powers that be wanted to have someone in place more willing to promote Polish nationalist views and, you know, exclude the Jews. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Daniel Tordei is the author of The Last Flight of Poxel West, a terrific novel. He's also the director of creative writing at Bryn Mawr and the winner of the 2012 National Jewish Book Award for debut fiction. And you can, I think you should buy the book, just my personal recommendation. Tell us a little bit. There's a lot in this book about flying. And are you a pilot? How did you get that stuff?
You compliment me. I definitely am far too timorous of an Eastern European Jew to ever have flown a plane. But I actually, there's a whole sort of
what,
side of my
what kind
family.
Of job is that for a Jewish boy?
Exactly. There actually is like a part of my family who are all pilots. My father's sisters, both of her kids, fly for United and for Southwest. And I think some of their interest actually comes from the sort of model for the book. Again, this cousin of my grandmother's named Hansa North, who trained for the Royal Air Force and was injured while training and ended up both working and flying for British Airways for his adult life. So there's sort of like a whole part of my Eastern European Jewish family who are interested in flying. So I've had, you know, I've gotten to like co-pilot a Cessna a couple times. You know, more than anything, I think I was interested in the idea of trying to find a Jewish war hero somewhere in Europe during World War II, and I say hero with big quotation marks around it, and knowing that I had a family member who'd actually, you know, was a Czech Jew who had flown and trained for the Royal Air Force felt like very natural material for that.
So you put it hero in quotation marks because, and without giving away too much about the book, it raises the question of what a memoir is and what's fiction. I thought of the whole story of Jerzy Kaczynski and the Painted Bird. Let's talk a little bit about writing a book that has incidents, you know, a Jewish hero who wasn't a Holocaust victim, wasn't Elie Wiesel. You write about that in the book, too. And how you chose that, and that's kind of a delicate line to tread.
Yeah, I think it's a very delicate line to tread. You know, I think I had two sort of very separate ideas in sort of day six that led me to writing, and one was very much in what we're talking about, which was just thinking about maybe a kind of story we haven't heard of Jews who actively fought in the war effort in Western Europe during World War II. And the other was just a sort of overall interest in trying to think about ways in which memoirs become fabricated, or the ways in which we sort of, I think, have some pretty finite ideas about genre in 2016 that I bet, you know, they might not have had in like 1920. And so it was kind of a convergence of those two things.
So it kind of frees you a little bit. The kind of reveal where it turns out that maybe everything isn't on the up and up creates kind of an ongoing pain through the last part of the book. Makes it much more challenging. Was that harder to write?
It was, yeah. I think, you know, for me, there's this way in which, like, really good stories, not saying that this one's a really good story, but this book also won the National Jewish Book Award for Fiction, so at least some people liked it. but it, you know, I think for me, there's a way in which once you sort of discover the thing that there is to know, that's when the story starts to get told, right? I mean, if I'm watching Game of Thrones, I might care about finding out what happens to the characters. But for me, reading a novel, the novels I love, I think somewhere early on, you kind of know what's going to happen, and it's just a question of how the story is told. So I think for me, trying to make a believable character who's fabricated aspects of his memoir, but then to create a lot of space afterwards in which to hash it out and to allow the characters themselves to start bringing it off. I mean, I'm always interested in trying to keep a reader really, really engaged in a book. And a lot of that can happen from having scenes of action. And, you know, there's scenes here where we see a pilot flying through a lightning cloud while the lightning is striking. But I think, you know, most writers, and certainly for me, I would love to just be able to sit two characters down at a table and have them talk for 10 pages and have my reader want to continue reading. And that's hard. But you know, creating the space for that to happen is, like, that's when you really feel like you're hitting on all cylinders.
Well, you know, any book that has baseball, World War II heroism, the Zohar, and a rich approach to Shakespeare all integrated, you kind of got me on a lot of levels there. My wife is a professor of English literature, so it adds in a lot of different ways. When you're writing and you're bringing in these elements, do you think, oh, I'm going to put this in here? Or does it just kind of evolve more naturally?
Yeah, you know, I think it tends to be much more natural. I teach creative writing here at the college level, and a big part of what I try to tell students is, listen, I think you have to just do whatever you need to do to get a first draft down. And it's once you've got that draft down that we can start talking about what it needs. So for me, you know, I think I knew that Poxel was going to be a Shakespeare scholar, and I had some ideas about that. But once I had a draft where we were sort of moving through, then there's this kind of more exciting, more selective, and more deliberate work of saying, okay, so, like, is A Winter's Tale maybe a better model for how this is going to move than Othello, than Macbeth? You know, and in those moments, you know, the subconscious gets to sort of start working along with the conscious to start making more kind of clear decisions.
This book reminded me of Mark Halperin's A Soldier of the Great War. I'm not sure exactly why, except, you know, a Jewish author writing about war in a very vivid way. And you have a tremendous command of language, beautiful images. What authors have influenced you?
Yeah, there are some of the just kind of obvious, I cut my teeth on reading Philip Roth and on reading Saul Bellow. There's a Jewish writer from the 70s and 80s who I think his star maybe has fallen a little bit just in terms of being read, named Harold Brodkey, who's sort of a really major short story writer in the 70s and 80s. And he kind of had like a flash of fame again in the 90s because he had contracted AIDS and wrote a series of pieces for The New Yorker about dying from AIDS. But I think in some ways that voice was really, really important to me. I'm also just a huge Faulkner fan. I don't know if I should say it out loud, but there are a couple sort of like moments of Faulknerian language that found their way in here.
They did indeed.
The Faulkner people found it. I'd probably get sued. But but they're, you know, that kind of elusive modernist dense language really excited me when I was a teenager and have always wanted to kind of keep it in there, you know.
So you have some of that, but in general, it's a lot easier to read than Absalom, Absalom. You have a remarkable way of integrating these two stories, not a brand new technique, but you bring them back together, the young boy and then Boxel's own narrative that becomes a famous book. Did you always intend to have them come back together?
You know, it's funny, and I don't know if it's always good for the reader to know how the sausage is made, but for a long time I actually had a draft where the first voice actually was a little different. It had this more sort of postmodern idea that there'd be a character who had actually received the memoir in the mail, and he would have written an introduction that like looked like an introduction you'd find in like a Penguin Classics. And it just felt really stilted and stale. And at some point in the process, I actually ended up writing this other voice for Eli in the form of a short story that I thought was going to be a standalone. And in the midst of the process, at some point, I said, well, what if I actually just kind of put the short story into the novella memoir and then smash them together? How would that work? And I think it ended up working pretty naturally. It actually didn't take that much work to start to get them together.
So it's a kind of a mashup is what you're telling us.
It is, yeah. And I think, for me, there actually was something really, I think it's hard to sort of consciously piece through, like, does this voice sound one way and does this voice sound another way? And if you start getting bean countery about it, it could get really stilted. But just having had them, like, not touching each other in two separate word files on a desktop allowed them to stay separate for a long time. And then when they came together, it was always pretty clear which was which.
I'm sure there was some criticism that there's too much sex in the book. I'm not the first one that, I'm not saying there is. Did anybody say that?
I think there's always a question when there's sex in a book. We tend to accept sex in TV and movies a lot more readily than we do in books.
Which is kind of funny because it's more explicit in the,
right,
never mind.
Exactly. My kids don't get to watch that.
Yes,
but,
exactly.
You know, there's a way in which Kurt Vonnegut had this great line where he said he never wrote about love because as soon as love comes on stage in a novel, it's all anybody cares about. You know, in some ways, this book was always going to be about Poxel's interest and love for Francoise. And I think, and for Glynis as well. And I think, you know, to watch an 18-year-old just become enamored of a woman for the first time, there's a way in which, like, those aren't scenes that you're going to elide. You know, I mean, if Chekhov is writing about a 45-year-old guy having an affair, then maybe we don't need to actually see it. But I think, in my conception of Poxel anyway, it just was so much a part of what he wanted to foreground that it had to find its way to the page.
It's powerful, and love and abandonment play an important role in the book, as do the truth of narrative. You're working on a new book. Tell us about it a little bit. Or you're working on a new project, I should say.
I am. Yeah, it's moving in the direction of completion. And I can say at this point that it is it's sort of loosely based on Julius Caesar. I was reading Julius Caesar actually as research for this book when I was thinking about Shakespeare. And I couldn't help but notice when I was reading it that in a lot of ways the relationship between Brutus and Cassius and Caesar looked a lot like a kind of millennials versus baby boomers generational divide that I think is pretty prominent today.
Ooh, I like that.
So I've been trying to find a way to kind of dramatize some of the qualms that the millennials are actively having with the baby boomers as they move off towards retirement.
And do they require knives to
well,
to effectuate the generational change?
There are no knives like in the play. I've also been really interested. The sort of other backbone text for it is Dostoevsky's The Demons, which is a novel about characters who are sort of engaged in, I think, what we would almost think of as, like, generational terrorism today. These guys actually, for ideological reasons, end up killing a friend in their midst. So I've been just kind of thinking about some of the bold and ugly violence that seems more prevalent than ever today, and trying to think about ways of actually getting it on the page.
I have to ask about the character of the rabbi in the book, purely out of altruistic interest.
Right.
He's kind of cool, is he based on anyone?
Yeah, you know, when I was a teenager, I had grown up in Boston, and my parents moved to Baltimore for a job for my father, and we went to this Reform synagogue, and like, a Reform synagogue in Baltimore was, like, barely even a synagogue compared to the synagogue that we went to in Boston, which that Reform synagogue, I think, felt almost like, you know, modern Orthodox,
right,
by comparison. And there was a new rabbi who had come to the shul, and he was young, and he was cool, and he was, you know, he had long hair, and he would bring his guitar out so that we could sing Crosby, Stills, and Nash songs at my confirmation from synagogue. So the character in the book is I mean, pretty whole cloth invented, but I think I did have in mind that
that such rabbis exist.
That such rabbis exist who are cool and young and know how to play chords, but also who I mean, I think, you know,
and,
I think
and
Eli
might have the Zohar on their shelf and have
it. And may also have the Zohar over their right shoulder, exactly. But I think also just, you know, the relationship between Poxel and Eli is fraught. And Eli's in a moment where he's vulnerable, and it felt like it was really important to have a role model come along who sort of, like, wasn't of the generation that Poxel was to him, which is, like, much more grandfatherly, and that person would be a little more, like, avuncular or brotherly, and also that it would be sort of coming from the side in a way that would seem kind of surprising and be able to disarm him.
And, you know, his parents are quite distant, good people, but clearly not close to the teenager.
Mm-hmm.
The book is called The Last Flight of Poxel West by Daniel Tordet. It's a great book. And where can people go to find out more about you?
Well, I have a website, which is just myname.com. The publisher is St. Martin's Press, and then the paperback now is Picador, has a really nice website there. I'll make a little plug. I have a story coming out. CNET, C-N-E-T, which is a technology website, has a new series called Technically Literate, which are stories about technology, short stories, and I have a story coming out there next week.
Excellent. Mazel tov, by the way. I want to thank Daniel Tordet for a great visit here on Too Jewish, and we look forward to talking again and talking about your next project.
That'll be fun.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be the wonderful storyteller Joel Ben-Izzi, who has a new Hanukkah book out. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website and friend us on Facebook. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes as part of our pre-Hanukkah musical preview. It's the most recent of Adam Sandler's Hanukkah songs, number 4 from last Hanukkah. The Greatest Hanukkah on Earth show, number 18, Shine All Night, is coming up this very afternoon at Temple Emmanuel. Today, December 11th at 4:30 p.m. It's free and open to absolutely everyone. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Hanukkah is the festival of lights. Instead of one day of presents, we get cake. When you feel like the only kid in town without...
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.